Michael Haneke. Before you get into why you liked him, how you found him, I'm going to give a couple of quotes which perfectly represent him and why I like him. Michael Haneke says, "My films are intended as polemical statements against the American barrel dam cinema and its disempowerment of the spectator. They are an appeal for a cinema of insistent questions instead of false, because they're too quick, answers, or clarifying distance in place of violating closeness for provocation and dialogue instead of consumption and consensus." In other words, he's anti-Hollywood. And he wants to make films that don't conform to the need to explain things with happy endings, resolutions at all points, etc. That's what that is. His second quote, which I love even more than that, is this: "Consider the pigeon, just the pigeon." In a Michael Haneke film, what you see is what you see. And as you know, that is what I like from films. I don't mind going underneath this. I like seeing things under the surface bubbling, rising to the top. I don't like to go any further than that, especially because unrelating to what's in front of your eyes. You never have to do that with Haneke, because it is right in your face, presented in most of the time a miserable, very, very unpleasant, but thoroughly engaging way. So take those two quotes and put them into his films that are, generally speaking, either based on something that has happened for a fact or something that is happening around the time that he made the film. And for me, Paul, you have got yourself one of the best directors in history.
I agree. And I think what's interesting is because you'd watch his films and think he was a really miserable, cynical person. But he isn't. And no. I think he makes the films about these subjects, which are awful and miserable, because he doesn't like that. And he actually has a great degree of hope within him, unlike A Most Wanted Man, which was built on cynicism, an absolute commitment to cynicism. And so actually, Haneke's films are actually more depressing and more bleak and more miserable and with less hope. But they're made by someone, and it comes through it in every pore, that actually he thinks there can be a better world. And he's exploring these as a way of us seeing that. And again, I like the idea of not patronising the audience. I think there is a lot of depth to them. And it's a difficult one when he sits there saying, you know, what you see is what you get. And like, the pigeon is a pigeon. The pigeon meant a lot, even though the pigeon is a pigeon, because it's both. And so I think he's probably the best European film director at the moment.
I would agree.
Possibly above Lars von Trier, because Lars von Trier gets a bit carried away with having fun.
As much as we love him, yeah, yes.
Indeed. There's some things you put in and you think, that's to shock us. It doesn't bear any relationship to anything else. You're just trying to shock us. Whereas with Haneke, everything is absolute perfection.
So we're going to start off in 1989, The Seventh Continent. This is the film that was based on truth. One of the ones that's based on something that actually happened. He read an article about a family, a middle-class family. She went to a nice school. The mother and the family had a good job as a dentist. He had a very good job. He'd just got promoted from his job and had even more money working in some sort of scientist lab things. It's a family that all of a sudden decided to kill themselves. Or rather, the parents decided to kill themselves and take their child along with her.
Yeah.
To the celestial plane. And the only he read an article on this and thought, how utterly pointless, why did it happen? Now, most directors would have tried to explain what the reasons why it might have happened, because, of course, the only people that knew were those, and they're dead. But they did leave a suicide note that basically said, we are going to do this, we're sorry. The suicide note didn't explain why the family did it. Mm. Again, the only people that know it are those that committed the deed. So, again, most directors would have said, right, what could it have done? Could it have been illness? Could it have been work was too hard and they got depressed? No. Haneke presented the mere facts of everyday life, the suicide, roll credits. And for this is actually his favourite film that he's made. He's come out and said that. And I can see why. Although it's not my personal favourite of his, that's to come. But it's a thoroughly engaging piece of cinema. In the sense that one of the Haneke traits, for those that don't know, is that he will show mundane scenes of normal, everyday things, and he'll repeatedly show them. Cars leaving the garage, cars going back in the garage, a lot of eating scenes. Now, isn't it interesting how most films actually don't have eating scenes in any film, because it's seen as mundane. A lot of Haneke's films have eating in them, because it's all about engaging you with these real people, doing real things, real characters. One of the most controversy follows Haneke in every film that he's done. And funnily enough, considering the subject matter of this film, Paul, the one scene that Haneke got lambasted for was the fact that the family, real money, real shillings, by the way, real German money, in amongst destroying all their possessions before they committed suicide, because they felt the need to do that, they destroyed their house, the fish tank, they put fish down the toilet. Nobody was bothered about that. But they also put 450,000 shillings down the toilet. That caused an awful lot of controversy when that film came out, as I'm sure you can understand.
Yep.
But it's such an engaging film. It's not going to be for everybody. And we have to stress, these are thoroughly miserable films. But they are unique for the reasons I've said. The fact that he would show a film where you know, where a family all of a sudden decides to commit suicide, and you see them taking pills, you see them giving a drink to the child with the pills in it, you see everything. Now, it makes me realise how little we actually see in other films, that we have to go back to 1989, to Haneke's first feature film, to see stuff of this ilk, Paul. Mm. Even now, it still surprises me, because I revisited a couple of them in preparation to do this, because I haven't seen them for 4 or 5 years. Incredible.
I think that's fascinating, and I love the idea that he does. He just shows it, because I think what he's saying is two things, and this is what makes him different. He doesn't come up with some psycho babble rationale, which is the Hollywood favourite. Give him a reason that some psycho babble drivel.
And this comes back to the quote at the beginning. Yeah, the anti-Hollywood. Absolutely. Resolution. There is no resolution for this family. It just happens.
But equally, the reason it happens is because we're alive. And people do these things.
Absolutely.
Who are alive. And so it's both. It explains it totally without explaining it at all. And without reverting to kind of like clumsy rationale that is ad hoc, random, and as likely to be untrue as it is true. Which is what you get in kind of English-speaking films by and large, and it is quite refreshing to see a film where nothing is explained, yet if you engage with it, it's completely explainable as being why it is. And, yeah. And there's very few directors that can achieve that.
And he knew very little about this family from the newspaper article that he read, which gave him the inspiration to direct the film about this particular family. Yeah. Because he doesn't know about it. We don't know about it.
Yep.
And instead, whilst everybody else would make shit up, as we've said, he did as much as he knew, which he presented the fact that they had a lot of money, they had a good job, she went to a good school, and all of a sudden, one of them's crying in the car wash, and then half an hour later, they're all swallowing pills. It's incredibly... it is what it is, and that's the exact point. And you mentioned there the ambiguity mixed with telling facts, along with you also, you know, bring your own interpretation of things with what he's telling you. The first masterpiece of Michael Haneke's collection for me is Benny's Video.
Mm.
Now, but I want to say as little about this as possible, because for full impact, you need to go into it completely bare. What I will say about Benny's Video is that, coming back to what I said about the films being made by people in that country, but also what's happening around you at the point the film's been made, this was made in 1992, which is... coincides with the rise of MTV,
mm-hmm.
Pornography and VHS. And in fact, generally speaking, quite a war-ridden time, wasn't it, in the 90s?
Indeed.
All sorts of conflicts around the world. And news became more and more about showing bloodied footage.
And not that far from Austria either.
Indeed,
you know, literally
not.
Just across the border.
You had all the conflicts going on there. And Benny's Video is essentially something that Haneke, again, brings a lot into a lot of his films. The horror of personality, which is a subgenre of horror films, whereby you have got, on the surface, not abhorrently evil people, normal-looking people. For example, the family in the semi-continent, they've got money, they've got a nice house, there's nothing on the surface, they're all nice-looking people, etc. Benny is exactly the same. He's a young minor, 13, 14, he's in a choir, he's intelligent, he's good at maths, he's popular, the family's got a lot of money, they live in a nice apartment and all the rest of it. But his mind gets warped by the VHS. He's obsessed with it. He's got a setup in his room where he films what happens outside. That's all I'm going to say on Benny's video. What I will say on it, though, is that you have to decide at all times whether Benny is a good person or a bad person. Now, this wasn't based on fact, but he still manages to give you a little bit of information for you to follow. The rest is up to you with what you're presented. And it is such an engaging film. This is probably in my top three of Haneke's entire list, Benny's video. In fact, I would recommend this to watch first. And if you can handle what this film throws at you, you can live with the one before, and you can certainly live with the one that would come after, the few that come after this.
Absolutely.
He would then move on to do another film based on truth, which is 71 Fragments of a Chronology of Chance. Now, this is based on a real life, again, this comes back to something you brilliantly made earlier. Human beings don't have to have a rationale to do bad things. They are humans, and therefore they will do bad things. Whereas Benny's video, the rationale was the rise of MTV, VHS, pornography, violence on the news and all that, which has an effect on Benny. This is literally a totally random bank killing that happened in Vienna. And the 71 fragments relate to the fact that lots and lots of different characters intertwine, and they all meet at the bank, and they all get killed by this stranger. Now, again, this comes back to the mundaneness as well, because I believe one of them is a Romanian immigrant living in Vienna, and a lot of them are all different caste system things, different jobs, different kind of people. But the guy who actually ends up doing the killing, he's the most ordinary guy you could possibly imagine, and he shows the mundanity of his life by one of probably Haneke's most famous scenes, Paul, and that is the table tennis scene. And he talks about this with quite a lot of proudness, really. That scene represents Michael Haneke to a T. It's literally the future killer playing against a ping pong machine that spits balls out to him, and he hits them back over the table to nobody, just playing by himself. And I think that scene goes on for about 8 minutes, just him returning ping pong balls back and forth. That is Michael Haneke. Now, he thinks, he even says, maybe that scene went on a bit too long. But you are watching this, expecting something to happen. This has to mean something, doesn't it? It doesn't. It's normal. It's life. This is a normal guy hitting balls on a ping pong table. And that scene represents his entire career. And he will go on to make some slightly less good ones, slightly better ones, one or two masterpieces. That's Michael Haneke. So I would probably say that's one of his better early ones as well, 71 Fragments, because it's the typical Haneke template. So that there's that one. And just to finish off this part one of Michael Haneke's career, is a TV movie that you are able to get your hands on. And it's Kafka's legendary, long-lost, unfinished novel that goes by the name of The Castle. Have you seen The Castle?
I haven't.
It's over 2 hours long, and you know it's an unfinished novel because it just ends. But it's honestly, I would also say this is one of his better ones. If we have seen God knows how many novels in films.
Yeah.
Hollywood loves taking novels. It has its own section on the bloody Oscar ceremony, for one thing.
Yeah.
Best, adapted screenplay. This is an incomplete novel, and it's so brilliantly made. Considering that it's not finished, you have to find out what happens. So you go onto the internet, try and find out what happens, and you can't, because there were never any plans. Kafka died whilst he was writing the novel. And apparently there were a few hidden notes hidden about somewhere that kind of revealed that the lead character dies. Would that be a surprise? Not really, because it's a Haneke film. The interesting thing about The Castle is that the name of the gentleman from The Lives of Others, Ulrich Moer, who's worked with Michael Haneke a few times, good actor.
Yep.
He's worked with Haneke quite a few times. He's brilliant in this. And it's essentially a film about a land surveyor who arrives at a small snowy village, and local authorities refuse to allow him to advance to the nearby castle. And increasingly complicated bureaucratic obstacles arise. So this is not your typical Haneke subject, but it's not his story. But this is where you can actually appreciate Haneke as a director. It's a thumb-image book film. There's not a lot of colour in it, but he gets the best out of very, very good actors. He also gets the best out of very, very good material from other people as well.
Mm.
So not only can he write stuff and direct things and produce things, he can take other people's material as well. And all these four films I mentioned today from Michael Haneke, I would recommend absolutely every single one of them. Various different reasons. They are all slightly different, but they're all, like all great directors, there's a common thread here.
Well, and they've led him up to being the director he is now. And I think, you know, it's like you said, there's bits of the later, greater movies in all of them. And you can see how he's developed and he's learned both the storytelling or anti-storytelling, as well as kind of like the use of camera, how long a shot needs to be to get the point he's making. Not for us to enjoy it, which we do at the same time, but like the table tennis scene. In all of his other films, there are lengthy scenes, but they're perfectly timed. And you've got to make an 8-minute one that you think probably should have been 5:50. To do that, and that's nice to see a kind of technique that you learn and perfect throughout. So, absolutely.
As a final point, you may think, oh, well, of course he's going to make mistakes and all the rest of it, and obviously do better ones. There are some ones later on that I don't like as much as his early ones. So it's not necessarily just the automatic, like, his later ones are the better ones. You'll see what you think of these when you're watching these four. But the important point to make is that he came from the theatre.
Yeah.
His father was a theatre background. He came from a theatre background. He did some TV, very, very small TV things, including some Liverpool Football Club thing, I think. But some other odd things. So his techniques that he's brought from the theatre, the fact that he can get the best out of all the actors, and quite interestingly enough, we hear all directors all the time saying, I thought of that film for that person. I wrote this film for that actor.
Mm.
And then when you actually watch the film, it could have been any actor.
Yeah.
They say it because the casting director hired the actor.
Mm.
Haneke actually does this. He actually chooses films for the actors.
Mm.
As we were just, when we call, probably when we move on to, well, for parts 2 and 3, mm. that's particularly the case with the certain actresses that he likes to work for,
yeah.
and what they bring to the film and what he gets the best out of them as well.
Well, let me just add a couple of things. I think what's interesting is he's a European. He's an Austrian and he's a European. So, for example, all of his films, they're not all in German.
Well, he's fluent in French, German and Austrian.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And equally, I think, thinking about what you've just been saying and how you've described it, I think the key thing is his Austrianness and when he grew up. He grew up in an era post-war, he's very developed, and actually Austria was a problematic thing because they're not the good guys, but they're not the bad guys. No. And it's that in the middle, and in a way, that permeates. So it's not about whether you're the good guy or the bad guy, it just is. And I think that's about being an Austrian, who a lot of them supported the Nazis and, you know, and fundamentally...
And turncoated as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, but they're not the bad. But equally, they're not the good guys who fought it and rebelled against it. And that actually is about, that almost the essence of the people in his films, is about they're not the good guys and they're not the bad guys. It just is.
The middle films of Michael Haneke then. I'll get you involved quite quickly, Paul, because I know you've got something to say in all of these. But first of all, let me just allow me to say that this for me is it's the second masterpiece of Michael Haneke's career up to this point, and that is the quite masterful Funny Games, really. What can I say about Funny Games that hasn't been said by far greater people than me? I'm going to say as little as possible is my answer, because you need to go into this fresh, as much as possible. As soon as you hear the heavy metal music as the family are driving down back to the home, and well, of course, they're listening to classical music, and then the camera pans out, you hear this god-awful heavy metal voice, really, with big, and the classic horror thing, big fat red letters on your screen, Funny Games. You just know that you're in for something a little bit weird and a little bit different. The film, very basically, is about a family that gets invaded by strangers, and their lives change forever. And it seems simple enough. The film is far from simple, which is why it's a masterpiece. First of all, we've got the Haneke traits that we've talked about when we talked about his films quite a few episodes ago now. The long scenes. One in particular involves a still shot over the death of one of the characters. And it stays focused and you actually see the
you actually see the corpse in all of its bloody glory. Glory, I should say, and gore for that matter.
Glory, glory.
Glory, glory. And you see it, and you know, you focus on it. It feels like an absolute age. At that point, you are so invested in each of the characters that you are desperate to get your eyes off the corpse. But it doesn't go for at least 3 or 4 minutes. It feels like an absolute age. And that is, as we talked about many times with the table tennis scene and some of his other scenes in his other films, that is the Haneke trait of making you so engrossed with the film, he will put the most disturbing or the most pointless or the most boring thing, and you're constantly expecting something to happen. And then you just realise you've been staring at a corpse for about 5 minutes. That is Michael Haneke. But that's not even the best part of the film, that kind of Haneke trait. The best thing about this film is the direct manipulation of the audience in this film. It's the most unique wall-breaking film probably I've ever seen. Although, I'm sure Blazing Saddles has got something to say about that. But the way that Haneke manipulates us in his twisted and demented way, just as the invaders and their funny games mess around with the family, it's utterly mesmerising. And as a footnote to this, please God, do not watch the Naomi Watts remake. Because even though it's a frame-for-frame copy, it's exactly the same. You'd be surprised how engrossed you get, and this is why we even do the podcast. With the subtitles, you really have to you really get drawn into a film easier. I think so, because you've got to read, and your eyes have to constantly switch between the faces and the words. It makes such a difference watching the original of Funny Games versus the American one. I've seen both numerous times, and the American one's not even a patch, even though the scenes are exactly the same. So that speaks, you know, testament, really, to subtitled cinema. And Funny Games, Paul, is a masterpiece.
It is. It's quite a disturbing masterpiece. And again, I think what is good and interesting about Haneke is that it's a mould-breaking film. And yeah. I think that's particularly true of Austrian cinema, but it's also true of the kind of video footage one as well, because they film it, don't they?
Which you talked about in Ben's video.
Indeed. Yeah. So, and again, the use of that it's almost like the found footage kind of stuff, that this preceded and again started that trend. So again, that makes it a unique film in what it started. It almost predates the kind of gore porn films of kind of like Saw and all of those, as well as that. And it's 20 years old, basically.
I know, it's unbelievable. 1997.
Absolutely. So it was made in 96, probably written in 95.
The rise of MTV and VHS porn and everything.
And that's quite an interesting era that it taps into. And again, it's that constant use. And I think it's a common thing about how the image and looking is the core of kind of like the human being, and how that's distorted by media, particularly. Yeah. And I think this is the first one that really gets it and delivers that as a message within something that's quite original and challenging at the same time.
Because, of course, the invaders are quite young. They're early teens, just as Benny is from Benny's video. So the effect that he believed in between those films during that period is getting worse and worse and worse. Yep. So Benny's video, which is disturbing as fuck, not even a patch in terms of the level of disturbance on this film. It's quite remarkable. Moving on to Code Unknown, which he had a little bit of a break after that. Moved on to Code Unknown, which...
I think the thing about Haneke, he does keep breaking into going back to television and filming operas.
Indeed.
Which, again, is interesting. We're not doing any of them, because I imagine we're neither of us particularly.
But that's because his father had the theatre background, isn't it?
But we're not opera fans.
No, we're not. It's just not what this podcast is about, clearly.
So, but it is interesting, because I think so you're talking about a guy who demonstrates... He's a really clever know. He knows both popular culture and high art, and his ability to merge them into kind of unique films is quite significant.
And he made most of these films when he was old. And what I mean by that is he was a late starter, wasn't he? I think he was late 30s, early 40s when he made his first film.
If he's 70 now, he made Funny Games in his 50s.
Exactly. So how many 50-year-olds are so in touch like Michael Haneke was? Yeah. So really interesting stuff. Code Unknown. Now, when I decided that we were going to do look back at all of Haneke's films, there were two that stuck out as my initial memory of classic directors. There are two that came up that I remember not enjoying particularly. One of which we'll be talking about next time when we look back at all, his final bunch of films. And the other one was this one, really. This one honestly feels just a little bit pointless to me. We're still going to recommend it. By God, you know, I wouldn't be crazy enough not to do that. But it's not a portmanteau film, is it?
No.
It's one of those that interconnects various characters over one event. And the event is basically Juliette Brioche.
Yeah. Binoche.
Indeed, I know.
Binoche.
Juliette Brioche. And her son, and a slight altercation with a black French person and a Romanian gypsy. And the entire film takes... You follow these four... The event happens, and then you follow the story of the actress. She's an actress in this film as well, which why slightly... Film within a film thing annoys me, which The Visit does as well, which we'll be talking about next time on the podcast. Yeah, the film within a film has to be really careful, otherwise it ends up being a fucking pain in the ass. And this film has the journalists talking to each other around a dinner table thing, which, again, we talked about on the last episode of Pissing Me Off. But so lots of little problems with this film, really. But you follow the actress of Juliette Binoche when she's filming a film in the film. You follow the son going back to his father in a kind of an odd little relationship there. You've got the black guy who started the altercation, the Senegalese / French black man. You follow his life and what happened to him after the event, you know, and things happening in his family. And then you travel back to Romania to follow the Romanian gypsy who got kicked out of France after the altercation. So you're finding all these people, and it's just, you know, the thing about this kind of film, and I'm actually going to praise Hollywood here, so, you know, hold on to your horses. Like, Hollywood does this kind of thing quite a lot, actually.
It does.
And it uses cliche to ensure that all the characters do have a specific role within each other's life. This isn't that, because none of these characters ever meet ever again, necessarily. I think maybe once or twice, maybe the ones in France meet by chance. But there really is no connection here. Which is fine if you actually believe in the butterfly effect, but I don't. So I don't get the purpose of this film in particular. How can there be literally a connection apart from one particular event? And the event is over. It happens and then everyone gets on with the rest of their lives. Which is the point he was trying to make, really. But it's not a particularly great film for me. I do like the look of the racism in France and the class. But again, he does that much, much later on in his career with better films. I thought this, by Haneke's standards, bloody hell, I mean, most of the films aren't even that long. This is too long, this film, for me. And the link was just too tenuous between all these people. So this is one that I got on with the second least out of his career, really. I don't know about yourself.
I don't think it's that bad. I quite like the idea. It's almost an experiment in looking at kind of character development.
I mean, to be fair, he even calls the film a series of incomplete stories.
Yep.
That's the actual name of the film in French.
Yep.
So, you know, it is what it is.
Well,
it is
you didn't
that.
Say that in French. Well, it's dead.
Let's see. Incomplet de divers voyages.
VR voyage. Absolutely. And I think, in a way, that's what it is. And yep. In a way, that's because that's what our lives are.
Yep.
For example... you moved to Italy, I moved to somewhere else. We'll probably never see one another, but we've had quite a relationship. But you move on. But that's true of, you know, in incidences that can change your life that actually, worse than this, you almost never think about, but actually had a greater impact. So I can see why it's a bit disappointing, and it is much more of an experiment, and I quite liked it for that. You know, when I saw it, I used to think Juliette Binoche was just an incredibly looking woman.
You did. She was your favourite.
She absolutely is. And so, a big fan of her. So I just...
I know you. You're probably any old shit, she isn't.
Absolutely. So, and actually that substitutes quite a lot of her latter career.
Indeed it does, yeah.
Shit that she did. So it was quite nice. And again, the use of deafness, you getting me to watch a disability film, was quite interesting. But
how much disability was there in Men in Chicken, exactly? quite a bit, by the way. So don't hold that stick against me.
So it was quite a bit. But usually they say, no. But again, I quite enjoyed it. But I think it suffered from being between... which we'll come to in a minute. Two exceptional films.
Indeed.
Funny games for the particular kind of groundbreaking film that it was, and then leading to the next one, well, The Piano Teacher.
You've led us quite nicely, so I want to introduce The Piano Teacher for us.
Well, basically, The Piano Teacher is about a young man who romantically pursues his piano teacher, who's a lot older than him, and it becomes a kind of masochistic kind of relationship.
She's living with her disabled parents.
Indeed.
And she's extremely sexually repressed.
Yep.
And that leads to all sorts of fantasies that she tries to play out in real life. She gets disappointed, and the film takes on from there, really.
And of course, it stars Isabelle Huppert. And of course, again, big fan of Isabelle Huppert.
She's not a beautiful woman. I'm sorry.
She is a beautiful woman.
Oh, Paul, no.
She is a beautiful woman. She is fantastic. So I
think, if you like farmer girls, yeah.
If my dream film would star Juliette Binoche,
oh,
Isabelle
I don't
Huppert,
know, I don't hear about your fantasy.
And Max von Sydow.
And a wheelchair.
So, well, that's me, obviously. So, but Benoît Magimel, who I'm not a big fan of, he plays the young student. He's kind of moved into bigger and better films since this. Not better, but bigger. Because, in fact, nothing better.
Oh, can't, I know. I can't think it'd be better.
Because this is just a masterpiece. And I think it is about the kind of nature of a relationship between a young person and an older woman who's repressed, and he's trying to think, and the way it becomes obsessive, kind of almost destructive yet beautiful at the same time. So this I remember seeing it and thinking this is a truly, truly great film. The longest of them all.
Yeah.
Actually, it's well over 2 hours.
Not even close to feeling like
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Not even close.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, I like the violence in this film. Basically, all of these films have a violent tendency to them, about destruction of either ourselves or each other or the society. There's the oppression as well. Now, that's why a lot of people... I think it was Marconi who said, one of the days they're going to actually advertise a Haneke film on the side of a bus, purely as a joke, because his films are so utterly miserable,
yep.
So utterly oppressed, repressed as well, that it would never happen. This is the perfect example of that. You know, the masochism, the violence in it, the sexual frustration, it's all in there. In fact, I remember watching this for the first time, and I actually almost fainted. I might have even done it, actually, because it does some extreme stuff that you think, this is an old man, and she's not exactly a spring chicken herself.
Not at this point, no.
No, and although her legs look a bit like chicken. Anyway. but it's... back to the, we're talking back to the first film again.
The beautiful Isabelle.
The mutated chickens, but it's utterly mesmerising cinema again.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it goes places no other film had gone before, particularly in a kind of mainstream French cinema way. And I think it delivers both a message, insight...
On the ending is terrific.
Understanding.
The ending is absolutely terrific.
Just in a way that
One of his best endings, actually, which you're obviously not going to spoil if you haven't seen it. I did not see it coming a million miles away.
Yeah.
Because you finally think she's kind of got her head sorted in a space where she's happy and she's about to play a concert and things, and then what happens? And just the fact that she is a piano teacher, the meekest and most mild of professions. Of course, what Haneke always does is flip it. And he flips it to the extreme where it's like, what the hell am I watching? In the best possible way. And there's
But I would say equally, it's done by a man who understands music, who probably plays the piano. And actually, this is a piano piece, wrote visually.
But I think we're in agreement, Paul. This has actually got better as he's got older.
Absolutely.
And I think we're all a fan of, well, at least two of these. Time of the Wolf, Paul. Or as it's known, Le Temps de Loup. Le Temps de Loup. It principally...
You wish it slag me off to say the proper title.
Oh, I love it. Oh, because I can actually carry it off.
Last time. I'm so glad you're doing the white ribbon. I'm looking forward to you reading that.
Indeed. Le Temps de Loup, Time of the Wolf. It principally follows a gathering of people in a post-apocalyptic world. I think this one, Paul, is probably the bleakest film in the entire history of cinema. It's also the most miserable film of Haneke's career. And there is no hope for anybody at any point during this film. Or is there? Which leads me to explain why I think Haneke is truly a master of his craft. Because if I put this into perspective for people about what Haneke is really about. If you imagine a Venn diagram, on the left circle, you've got rationality or irrationality. On the opposite side, you've got reality.
And right in the middle, intercepting, you've got audience manipulation. And this film uses all three, and his best films use all three to create films that you simply cannot stop watching. Here we have a post-apocalyptic world. We don't know why, so we spend the time looking for clues. At no point are there any clues about why the world is what it's like, but we keep watching in the hope that there will be something. 57 minutes later, nothing has happened in the film, and yet you are still watching the film. At this point, you've already stopped trying to rationalise something totally irrational, and you've accepted it. You're in the film, and you're there to the end. That is Michael Haneke. To manipulate us more, he promises that there will be hope in this film. He promises us continually. So when the people, when the killers of the family's father come back to the massive concentration camp they've got, if you will, massive gathering of people, when they come back, you want them to be killed by the other people because they are bad people. But they are not killed. They are, in fact, integrated very nicely into the rest of the group. And the best thing that which comes into the next film as well, the ending that could well mean something could also be totally unrelated and totally meaningless. You rarely get the answers you want. You even less frequently get the results you want. So after you've got through all of this film, which is it's a fairly lengthy piece, you're pushing 152 hours. Mm-hmm. After you've got through all this, you realise you've spent nearly 2 hours trying to rationalise something that's irrational, that's not even real. It dawns on you that if it was real, it would play out exactly as you've just witnessed. You've been manipulated from the first minute to the last. Groups would form in real life if this was to happen. Groups would form, it would swell and it would swell. Leaders would lead and would be despised by everybody, as is the case in modern day society. All trust would go. All hidden racial prejudices would come out into the open. He captures it so, so amazingly well. I must admit, the first time I saw this film, about 7-8 years ago, I did not get the gravitas of it. Mm. This is one of his most underrated pieces for me. It is a bloody interesting thing, Paul.
Well, I agree completely, and I think it is. It's up there as one of the top films. It's in a tough week.
The it got list competition. We're looking at.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's the fourth film of the week, in my view. but equally, it's still better than anything we've done in the previous list. I'm surprised you like it, given that your arch enemy, Isabelle Huppert, is in it. And obviously, you know how I love Isabelle Huppert. So I think that...
She's not a beautiful woman.
Yes, she is. But I love his... He's not about giving answers. He's about exploring ideas.
Yep.
And exploring and letting you interpret in the way you want to about the nature of society. And again, what would happen with the breakdown of society, how it would go. And actually, we just replicate the same old shit we've already got, leading back to the breakdown of society. And it just becomes an ever fulfilling, not an abyss, but just a spiral of mundanity, if there's such a word, banality, and just the same thing over and over and over again, which is what I presume is his view of history. And it's just, you know, with better housing and central heating and better sanitary.
And well, this was 2003.
Yeah.
So he's seen the developments of class, if you will,
yep.
of people trusting their governments less and less, which fits in remarkably brilliantly
with today,
but also his next film, which you're going to introduce, Paul, which I know up to a point was your favourite film of 20 years, until the one that would come after, which then became your favourite film of the last 25 years. But please, you have the honour of introducing, for anyone who doesn't know it, Cachet.
Cachet, or commonly known in English as Hidden.
Yeah.
2005, it's just under 2 hours. And basically, it's about this married couple, played by the equally lovely Juliette Binoche.
Juliette Binoche.
And the great Daniel Auteuil. Basically, someone starts leaving videotapes of surveilling them on their doorstep. And it's the paranoia and fear and terror that they go through. And again, not a lot happens, as is often the case within Hanukkahville. And in fact, the next one is probably his most action-driven movie of all time. But hidden, and so not a lot happens actually throughout the entire movie, and it is just them becoming more and more anxious as a kind of middle class couple about the nature of someone surveilling them. And again, so it is about society the way it is today, and they don't ever catch him, do they? Remind me, it's been a while. Since but it just stops, or does it, or they go,
yeah.
They learn to live with it. And then it ends with them on, people on the steps and people...
Magic.
Yeah. And it's just, it is just a fantastic film. I think one of the joys of Haneke is that he gets the best people to work with, actors, actresses, as well as designers. But he also has the most simplistic of ideas that he explores with an absolute scientific kind of intellect. I'm not going to say forensic because people use that word wrongly all the time. But an absolutely scientific dissection of the nature of both people's psyches, the way they're manipulated, how they accept certain things that are absolutely awful, but then become paranoid about something trivial. And again, Cache is a bit about that, because like, we're all videotaped and surveilled all the time, and actually we all welcome it more and more as days go by. And yet, you know, if someone did this to you, put a film of you on your front door, that they were following you, you would be outraged, you would become paranoid and terrified. Yet the state does that with absolute impunity now. And it's that parallel of ideas and realities that we live with and the contradictions of society. And so it's just a masterpiece.
It really is. It's, you know, the paranoia behind the surveillance, around the surveillance, but not only that, between different people of different classes.
Yep.
Because they're a very middle-class family, and the people who they believe are recording these videos, they are, again, from a council flat, if you want, in France. He gets French class, fantastically, well, European class, moreover. This is also a found footage thing that he did, again, before, with all, the, I mean, you know, I'm a fan of fan footage, I really am, as we talked about, but this was there on the early days of it.
Race,
class, you know, up to this point in Haneke's career, by far his best film, by far his most complete film. Now, I'm going to mention the ending in part because it's worth discussing. 99.8% of all directors would have had the son of the family walk off screen with the person who we think has filmed the videos, automatically making us think, oh God, what's going to happen to the son? Is he going to take revenge on the fact that the father, who was accused of doing the videos, killed himself in the film? So is he, you know, you know that's going to happen. The two people that would not have done that ending: Kurosaki, who would have just had everyone die off, quick pot satisfaction. And then what Haneke decides to do, and we're not going to spoil it, but what Haneke has chosen to do in this film is both initially frustrating for about half a second, because it's natural to want the resolution that you want to get. But it is so utterly perfect what happens in this film. And, you know, it's the fact that you want your resolution, you very rarely get one with him. Pure imagination. Just imagine, pure imagination. And that is him in a nutshell.
And moments where you're shocked. For example,
always.
The father who he thinks is doing it kills himself. And again, you're not expecting that.
And believe, even though we told you that it's going to happen, folks, you won't be expecting it when it happens.
Absolutely. And you just think, wow. You know, and it takes you back. And again, it's that whole notion of you know, that if he'd have been a white Westerner, middle-class Frenchman, he wouldn't have even have done that. And, you know, and yet, and so he can't cope with it. And I think he goes home and he shuts himself in his bedroom, lays down and shuts the curtains, doesn't he? Just this pretense that the world is happening around him, which is, you know, an indictment of middle-classness. Which, again, fantastic stuff.
And it can't be a French film without literature in it.
Indeed.
And they talk about it a lot. They do. So there's that as well.
But now, you can turn off for that, baby, if you want.
do you not like that stuff?
Well,
it makes me feel...
It's so terribly French.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, but I love that. That's what I want. I really want that.
And, of course, because I hate reading. I've hardly ever read any.
You also hate the middle class.
Yeah, I do. I hate the
middle class. Which is why we don't get on.
Yeah. well, it's because it's what we both are. But I think it's just so terribly French, and it's that. And again, because it's kind of like an in-joke amongst French, because they're the only people who read any of these fucking books.
Indeed. So. I get the pleasure now, Paul, of starting off with one of your favourite films of all time, by the way. I think it probably is. The White Ribbon, also known as Das Weißband, eine deutsche Kindergeschichte.
Very good.
It's a film...
Probably wrong, but...
No, it's 100%...
Is it?
Possibly right. It's a film about life pre-World War I in a small German village. There are at least a dozen little storylines as we meet all the characters. The Baron, the Baroness, teacher, the pastor, all their children. as a number of atrocities take place over the course of a year, year and a half.
Yep.
Which threaten the peace of their way of living. Paul, I know you can't wait to come on in this, but you're just going to have to wait a few minutes because I've got a bit to say about this. Masterpiece is often used too much by the both of us. I think we'll both admit that, frankly. But it's very easy to do after seeing a film. You know, you get overexcited about what you've just seen, and it's just 10 out of 10, brilliant, loved it. This really is what Masterpiece was meant for. It's an absolutely fundamental film for everybody needs to see, I would say. Everybody. It's Haneke's best film. It's one of German cinema's most important films. And it's one of, I'd say, European film's finest 2.5 hours. The beauty of its production, the sophistication of its execution, the performances, the writing. There's so much depth to it. There's so much to it. Like, for me, the core of it, Paul, I mean, we might even have a completely different thing on this. For me, the core of it is something that actually only really comes out halfway. And that is when it's revealed that one of the children in the village was having psychic dreams about the events that were happening in the village. So she predicted that the disabled child would get his eyes burnt. She predicted that the horse would trip over some wire. She predicted all of that, the child in the film. And for me, Haneke runs with that idea by connecting this pre-war village and turning it into what would eventually happen to other villages after the breakout of war, even though it's not been declared yet. There is so much symbolism about indoctrination, either religious or ideological, i.e. what Goebbels would do. We see hallmarks of what Mengele would end up doing, for example, with the old guy with the protruding eye, the disabled tortured boy, because we know what happened to disabled children there.
Mm-hmm.
The abuse of children, the brutality of it, and also each other as well, not just kids. Kids growing up knowing about death, being able to talk about it. I mean, for me, that scene involving the young boy and his sister talking about death is my favourite Haneke scene ever. And potentially, of all time, that exact scene of any film, of any director, it is just his greatest piece of direction. The way that that child delivers those lines so unbelievably brilliantly. And there's humour right at the end of that scene as well, with the cutlery off the table. It is just a brilliant scene in just such a brilliant film. We cannot stress it enough, Paul. There is just absolute perfection.
Well, and I think what it does show, because it shows that I'm not obsessed with length, as I always seem to be with every film we ever discuss. It's always too long. This is, as you've said, 2.5 hours easily, and it is brilliant from beginning to end. What it captures is by creating a microcosm of Europe within one village, and then going with it to dissect war and society and people in the modern world. And it does that to perfection. It then comments on the future, it comments on the past, and it comments on the moment of its time as well. It captures class in a way that no other film does. Not even Ken Loach captures class.
Give me your favourite.
I'm not a particular fan. I love his kind of ideology and everything, but his films tend to be a little bit boring and a little bit kind of ideological. When in fact they don't need to be, because you can actually do it much more, with much more perfection and precision within a narrative that absolutely pulls you in and lets you explore the whole nature of a society. And this does that in a way that I think no other film does. And this is probably the best film of the 21st century so far. And what, we're 15, 16 years in, and it is just so far ahead of any other film going. It talks about disability in a way that virtually no other kind of film about the war does, which again, obviously, from my perspective, is excellent. But it does it in a way that's rooted within the narrative, rooted within the nature of that society. It's not an add-on. It's not kind of pushing a particular agenda, but it's there. But it does that on every aspect: class, gender, age, kind of from children to old people to young people to middle-ranking people, gender, sexuality. It's all there in a way that is just perfection. About exploitation, about, you know, the way societies are structured, not just about class, but kind of agrarian, rural, kind of a city
as well.
It's just all there that makes it the most perfect film, and it's 2.5 hours. And it could have been twice as long.
I mean, we could spend a whole podcast just talking about the film, really.
Mm.
And it did not win the Oscar that year. It was nominated. It really should have. As much as you know, the one that won, I was quite happy that it won. This was
what won? Do you remember?
I've briefly forgotten.
Right.
We have talked about it.
We have talked about that.
So yeah, just this incredible. Unlike, it feels really strange to say this. Unlike his most recent film, Paul, would you like to fill us in about Amour?
Amour. Well, basically, it's about a couple of 80-year-olds, a husband and wife, who you never really leave their flat. Pretty much throughout the entire film.
Most of which was green screen, which blows my mind, to be honest.
Indeed.
The windows were green screen. What? Windows, green screen. It's like,
Modern technology. He wants to push himself.
Why couldn't they have not found a flat with windows? is that Paris for?
Well, you don't know what might happen outside. And you get the feeling that Haneke is a man who likes absolute control. And I think there's the stories about the pigeon you know, that took so 30, many takes.
13 takes, the pigeon.
Because the pigeon wouldn't do what he wanted him to
do. Indeed.
It's a pigeon for Christ.
He always said a pigeon was a pigeon.
Absolutely. And basically, it's this retired, their music teachers, their daughter comes to visit them, who lives in Britain with their family. Again, played by the wonderful Isabelle Huppert. And
what's nice about her being in this film, Paul, is that she actually has looked like death warmed up for at least 25 years. So she fits in, for a film about death, she fits in quite nicely. Carry on, Paul, sorry.
And so basically then the wife has a stroke, deteriorates, becomes incontinent, bedridden, completely incapable. I don't know, it's revealing the ending by saying that he basically euthanizes her. But what's interesting is that, you know, I'm against euthanasia in any sense. I'm against assisted suicide. But it's fully logical within the nature of this film.
Yep.
So it's not about being for it or against it. It's just about the logic of this narrative that he's exploring age, the past, family, death, isolation, and kind of like as you get older, the world gets smaller. It's the flat, and then then it's the bedroom, and then it's kind of like where you sit, and then it's death. It's a great film. Again, I'm not sure it was the best film of the year. It won, actually, foreign language Oscar, because it did win it. And you do get the feeling that he got the foreign language Oscar because they should have given it to him probably 15 times before.
<That's right. laughs> Well, he always won at Cannes. He had the reputation of, well, he won at Cannes, and that's what he said. But no, this was the one that won.
But equally, and it shows actors who are legends, like, you know, the French Jean-Louis
Trintignant.
Indeed, who is a legend being an old man and showing his own age, his own deterioration.
His first film in 7 years as well.
And
so
the bravery to do that. And yeah, again, that's again about he gets these actors who are prepared to do this and buy into what he is trying to do and what he is trying to say and what he is trying to explore. Because again, it's not that he's trying to say anything, he's exploring, and you're exploring with him. And so, again, you know, as I said, I'm completely against it, but within this, it becomes the kind of perfect end to the world that he's creating, given class, wealth, gender, all of those kind of things, what these people perceive to be dignity, what these people perceive to be kind of notions of what it is to be normal, what it is to have value. So, and again, perfection, but not as good as a white ribbon or hidden.
Indeed not. It's a harrowing thing for me, this. How can it not be? But I don't regard this as a great film.
Mm.
It's the weakest one of this little section we've done by far.
Absolutely.
And I also prefer some of his much earlier work to something like this. You know, I couldn't quite get over the fact it was called Amour, because it's actually a film about death. It's not a film about love.
Mm.
And in fact, why would that be an issue? You know, because the film actually had originally two titles before it had Amour. It was originally supposed to be called These Two, and then after that, it changed to The Music Stops, which is a little bit more, you know, stereotypical, if you will. But Haneke was flickering between those two ideas until Jean-Paul Trintignant suggested that Amour was a better title because he felt it was a love story. And Haneke is a man that sticks to his guns. So for him to kind of change his mind like that on a whim almost, it kind of fits in with the overall confusion of this film, really. It was too long. I thought, you know, you're a fan of Death Warmed Up. She,
I would have thought it would have been a much better film. Hence why it was originally called These Two. I think it would have been far, far more interesting if it was just the pair of them. Just Reva and Tante Jean. I don't think her family added anything. I don't think they were there to meant add in, to add anything. I think she was literally just there for a meal ticket. which is ironic because she could do with a few more burgers. But the ending, I detest. I really... This is Hanukkah's worst ending by far. Completely botched it. Because it should have... That famous ending, one scene too late thing. Mm-hmm. I am going to spoil it. So if you want to watch it more...
Go on, spoil it.
I'm going to...
Yeah,
exactly. Because it won. It's 4 years old already, almost. So yeah. I'm going to... If you switch off for a time being if you want to skip ahead. But what it is... There are suggestions that it might all be a dream. I mean, it's not, but it potentially could be, because he wakes up and then they go off to the concert. It's not a dream, of course. What it is, it's going back to the beginning before anything happens. So they go off to the concert they were supposed to go to, then it fades to black. So you think, great. There is a very, very small percentage that none of that could have happened. Very, very... I've just watched 2 hours and a bit of pure fiction. I like that idea that you're playing with me, you're manipulating me in the middle of the Venn diagram again. I like it. Or then again, it's the classic Hanukkah thing of putting things in the wrong order that he likes to do a lot. Beginning of the end, the beginning. Again, I like that idea. To actually end as it did, to have one scene extra with Isabelle Huppert going back to the flat, sitting down, looking miserable, an utter waste of time. What was the point of that? So I was extremely... Because she was a little bit aloof from the whole thing. She had no... So what she had no... purpose to go back, really, because everything was over at that point. So it did not sit well with me at all. What I will say is that Reva deserved her nomination for Best Actress that year.
Yep.
She was incredibly brave to do some of the things she did. I read that she was petrified of being smothered, as I think it's fair enough.
You would be when you're that old.
Especially when you got an
with
older...
a big guy like Jean-Louis on top of you.
Especially since he was suffering with a wrist injury, so he wasn't sure if he could sustain himself doing it. the fact that she had a naked scene, which isn't what it sounds like, it's very effective and very, very important for the character's narrative, if you will, for her to be seen washed and that kind of thing. A bit more stereotypical, but it needed to have been done, and she said she believed she wasn't happy about it, as you wouldn't be. As long as it came about for the right reasons is what I'm trying to say, and that comes across well. Jean-Paul Trantijan, I think actually maybe I can see why he wasn't nominated for actor, but it is a film about a couple, so I'm a bit disappointed that he was never actually nominated for this. More so because of it was 7 years since he last acted, and that's not to be underestimated, really. If you don't do something for 7 years and then you do it every day for over a period of a few months, and that must be strange, and he pulled it off well. But they did. I wouldn't blame them for what I disliked about the film at all. They are not the issue. I also think it's interesting that this film was loosely based on something that happened to Michael Haneke's aunt. So is he showing his own fears of death? Yes. Is he showing his? He's entitled to do that. He can do what he likes. He's a director. And just as a final point, his number one message to this, when he spoke to the actors, was no sentimentality. And whilst we have slightly different opinions on how great this film was, we can both agree that it was not a sentimental piece.
Absolutely.
So, mission accomplished.
Absolutely.
And, all right, the wrong one won. And by the way, it was Campanella's A Secret in Their Eyes that won the Oscar in 2009.
Right.
Which was a very good film.
Well, it's good.
But certainly not in the league of White Ribbon.
Absolutely.
For Hanukkah to have an Oscar for anything is fine.
Yeah.
And if you want, you can call it a career Oscar, because he has deserved one for at least 3 or 4 films. So as we finish off Hanukkah, Paul, I think we could answer our own questions, really. But if you were to narrow it down to a key selection for people?
Well, I'd say pretty much it is those 4 films. I think that they cover quite a wide period of time. Perhaps one from the previous list, which I'd say...
Funny Games. You can basically put all the early ones in one big category.
Yeah.
And say the better ones, I would say Benny's Video and Funny Games. For the porn side, for the aggression, I liked all that side of it. Then skip right ahead, Piano Teacher We Can't Forget.
Indeed.
And then you got these.
But I think it's interesting to think about how for example, Benny's Video and Funny Games, in a way, are kind of like the two. They are excellent, but they lead to,
of course,
cachet.
Yeah,
which delivers it in such a perfection, but actually they are lesser movies because of that.
Oh, of course.
And again, equally with the
I do like the violent. Absolutely. I like the violent angle that the other ones necessarily and needed to have brought, and they did bring it.
Absolutely.
And he's always been about senseless violence and senseless things happening.
Happy End, Eric. Happy End. This will be the Austrian Oscar foreign language nomination for 2018. As well as the new film from, of course, Michael Haneke, who for me is the greatest active European director. Yeah, surprise, surprise again, it's about a bourgeois family filled with all sorts of suicidal and depressed characters, including the head of a construction company, played by Isabelle Huppert, her father, played by Jean-Louis Trintignant, so them two are reunited since Amour, which actually won Haneke a career Oscar, I like to call it, because I don't think the film itself actually deserved it. Anyway, we've also got a crazy son and my favourite actor, Toby Jones. Eric, I couldn't quite believe it when I heard that Haneke was not only doing another film, because it kind of, I was led to believe that he was kind of going to pack it in, but one with the unflappable Tony Jones. Toby Jones, sorry. And two of my favourite people together. Of course, my expectations were never going to be met. But even that being said, it's such a shame that I am left to step off the dream boat with a crushing sense of disappointment and a feeling of being significantly underwhelmed. And this is Haneke's second worst film he's ever done for me. Like, it's really, really unlike Haneke to put together something that threatens to sort some issues out and comment on modern life, but actually doesn't really do fucking anything about it. Like, there's some racism that goes nowhere, there's some stuff about social media that doesn't really go anywhere, assisted suicide that gets forgotten about, nothing. And worse, a man whose career is defined by ambiguity in the film, and, you know, interpretation's all important, there's nothing to be ambiguous about in this film. Everything is so predictable. And as I've already mentioned previously, you know, it can't even really be answered either, because there's nothing being offered on the table. Like, it may sound a little bit harsh for those that have seen it and have come away quite liking it, but, and you know, it's not a bad film in that sense, because, you know, even the worst of Haneke is still better than 85% of the world's output year on year. But, you know, still, even tinged with disappointment as I am, it's still watchable enough. I suppose what saves it from being the worst film of Haneke's career for me are the actual quality of the performances. Like, Naomi Watts and Tim Roth simply were not capable of keeping up with the gravitas of the US Funny Games remake. Whereas in this film, I've got no issues with Jean-Paul Trintignant. He does what he needs to do. Huppert is typical Huppert, and does, she doesn't look as pasty as she normally does, so that's quite a pleasant surprise. And as I say, Toby Jones is beautiful and wonderful and perfection, even having to handle such a pointless and dull character that he is in this film. Like, I've never seen an omelette eaten with so much suavity as that. And as for the crazy son, well, he provided me with the best singing dancing scene since Dogtooth. So that was great. But yeah, I was disappointed, Eric.
Yeah, there used to be a tradition in TV shows where, to save a bit of money, you throw in an episode every season that would be a clips episode, where somebody would go into a coma or something and they'd start having flashbacks, and it was a cheap way of, you know, getting an episode out without actually having to shoot an episode. This kind of felt like Haneke's clip show. It's like, it's just full of elements that we've seen in Haneke movies before, but they're just handled far less interestingly here. Like, you have, there's a bit of Benny's Video with, like, the 12-year-old girl filming various acts, like killing her gerbil, poisoning her mother. There's a bit of, kind of, as you said, we have the assisted suicide plotline from Amour comes back in, and the movie actually kind of sets itself up almost that it might be a sequel to Amour. Because Jean-Louis Trintignant seems to be playing the same character, but somehow now he's a millionaire who runs, like, a construction business, and I don't remember that being the case anymore.
Well, no, especially since he's upgraded his house threefold. He lived in a a dingy little flat with a pigeon, didn't he? So he's done well for himself. I'll give him that.
And Isabelle Huppert plays his daughter, but she's actually listed under a different character name than the character she played in the Moor. So it's all very, very confusing. But yeah, it just feels like we have kind of the class conflict that we saw in Cachet. It is a bit where there's an industrial accident on one of the building sites owned by this family, and a worker gets killed. So there's a scene where a member of the family goes to meet with his family, and it kind of erupts in a shocking moment of violence. And that kind of felt very like the scene in Cachet where Daniel Auteuil goes to visit someone and there's a shocking moment. It just everything in this just feels like kind of like a watered down version of something we've seen in a better Haneke movie in the past.
Yeah, it's amazingly been received quite well, which is baffling to me. I mean, I guess that people do watch shit movies all year round, so they can actually watch something like this and think it's good. Like, and it's good enough, I suppose. I mean, I got through to the end, as I expected I would, because it is Haneke after all. But and actually, the social media stuff, because of course the project that he was supposed to do before this film, Eric, if you remember, was something called Flash Mobs, I think it was. Supposed to be about youngsters kind of using social media to, like, I don't know, bully people and that kind of thing. And we kind of see a really random scene of, like, a young teenage lad, 12, 13. He's kind of, like, just doing a completely random, like, YouTube video. Like, it's almost as if, like, he just, whatever bits he had from Flash Mobs before he got cancelled, and he's never revealed why that was and that kind of thing, he just kind of just stuck it in the film just for the sake of art and call it art. Well, sorry, Michael, but what does it mean? but not even what does it mean, because that in itself is a success, making you think, wow. But actually here, you just know that it doesn't mean anything. You just know that it's a random piece of crap that's just been pasted into this film. So, yeah, real shame. I am now in two minds where I actually do want Haneke to pack it in now, because I thought Amour, he got his Oscar, and I thought that was the great time. But still, being the greatest living European director, active one, I thought, okay, if he does come back for at least another one, fine. But really now, I don't think I could stomach him doing two bad films in a row, because it's never happened in his career. So what's your instinct on this one, Eric? Do you think he'll come back for another one?
I'd like to see him go back to German language cinema.
Absolutely. His best stuff. I mean, good grief. The White Ribbon is one of the greatest films of all time for me. So that would be swell.